you can see a progression. You can see that God is getting his will accomplished. Despite the disobedience, the failure, the unfaithfulness of his people. I was just remembering a question this afternoon, something along the line of, how could God punish America? Or the Great Commission wasn't given to the United States of America, but to the evangelicals. And so if we don't fulfill it, how could God punish America? And something popped into my mind. Remember Jonah, who was on that ship, and the ship was just about to sink, and they finally discovered that it was Jonah's fault that the ship was about to sink? Why wouldn't God judge America for the disobedience of the evangelicals? When they finally discovered that Jonah was the problem, he was the one who had the most light, who had the most information. And not that he was worse than the other people were, but he was relatively worse. He had more light, and his sin was greater. And he was the chief problem. It was not the secular people, so to speak, that were the problem. It was the man who had revelation to deal with. Now, we talked about this gospel being given to Abraham, and there were those 11 chapters preceding that just set the stage for this story. And then this is an unchanging story of the radiation going out in bigger and bigger circles till you come into the entire Roman Empire here, and then up into Middle Europe, clear up to the Arctic Circle, and to some extent around the world. And certainly now, by the year 2000, the impact of Jesus Christ upon our planet is absolutely phenomenal. Mao Zedong, when he came into power, was asked the traditional question that all new dynasties in the history of China have always answered. The question some attendant asks is, what year is it? And the new leader says, the year is one. And so a new dynasty in Chinese history begins. So they asked Mao Zedong, what year is it? And he said, the year is 1951. Now, I'm not trying to make Mao Zedong out to be a crypto-Christian, but the fact that the impact of the man who lived 1950 years before that on the surface of the earth had been so great that there was no way for that vast middle kingdom of China, which from the Chinese point of view, it was always mankind. And everybody else was the riffraff, the marginal peoples of the world. For even that central kingdom, by the man who was probably in many ways the most powerful man who ever ruled China, perhaps the most powerful man in human history in many respects, in terms of the number of people that he commanded, he said the year is 1951. Now, I'm not trying to say, you know, that this, you know, we can just relax because everything is really going great. But I do believe that we must overthrow in our lives and in the lives of the people that we contact a kind of an ostrich-like fleeing from the facts, assuming that things are not going well, assuming that there's really no hope, that there's no real possibility of what we call closure. Of a real completion of a task. Now, to burrow in a little more in detail, let's take this just this last 400-year period here. These are 400-year periods, 8, 12, 16, 2000. Let's just take this last 400-year period here and see what we see. 1600, this is just after the Reformation, and there aren't any Protestant missionaries yet, but there are Catholic missionaries all over the world. The Catholics are mounting the steps of the Peking Palace in the person of Matteo Ricci, one of the most influential of all missionaries in history. 1700, 1800, 1900. Well, what's going on here? The Protestants are in sort of confusion. They're rebuilding the structure of their churches. They've done away with the Roman Catholic orders. They have no instruments of action. They only have instruments of nurture. That is to say, they only have, if you'll pardon the word, modalities. They only have caretaker, nursing, nurture structures. They don't have any outreach structures. And so no wonder, even if they had found the Great Commission in the Bible, they wouldn't have known how to do anything with it. Now, it is true that there have been a few notable exceptions. The Quakers, actually, here, did send a few missionaries. The Moravians came in through this marvelous spiritual transformation in Herrnhut. And, you know, Luther was way back off the screen here, but the Lutherans were having to contend with the Pietist movement, which was an outbreak of devotion that superseded, or I should say, which eluded the structures of the state church. And these Pietists were burrowing around in the Bible and finding all kinds of things and finding new obedience. And the Anabaptist movement was still in existence. And Herrnhut expressed the Pietist perspective in missions. And the Moravians had a prayer meeting, a 24-hour-a-day prayer meeting that lasted for 100 years. And boy, they really have a spectacular example. But they were just sort of an anachronism. They were very much like a Catholic order. They didn't send out preachers so much as communities, like monastic communities that went out and established whole towns. They had the entire spectrum of human skills in that town. And many American cities and other cities around the world were actually established by these missionary outposts, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania being one of the more famous examples. In this century, there appeared Wesley on the scene, just before the middle, and the evangelical awakening ensued. A tremendous, exciting development, a brand new book on that subject, The Radical Wesley, and Patterns for Church Renewal by Howard Snyder, who's written several other books, something like The Trouble with Wineskins, or something like that. And then the Community of the King. He's all the time thinking about the structure of Christendom. But this book is his doctoral dissertation on the nature of Wesley's work and ministry. And he has some very interesting diagrams in here about the substructure of the Methodist community. And no matter what you think about the Methodist movement today, you've got to admit that that early movement was a very highly disciplined and just fabulously successful Christian movement. And yet, somehow, when this tremendous spiritual outpouring took place in the evangelical movement, it just didn't funnel into missions. And we've got to learn one thing, that spiritual renewal does not necessarily refocus us on the external obligation of the gospel. It is very possible for people to be renewed and to become overstuffed with blessings and to write books on a deeper life and all kinds of wonderful things and never really offer themselves to the mainline concern that God has. It's not proper to say that there is in the Bible a basis for missions. The Bible is based on missions. You can talk about the missions base of the Bible, but there is no other story in the Bible. That's all there is God's relentless love reaching out to all of his creatures through those whom he blesses, and if they will not share those blessings, that is bad for them. And it took William Carey is the man in 17, early part of the last decade, to confront a few pastors with the Great Commission, and they said, "Nah, that has nothing to do with us." Well, more specifically, they said, "Sit down, young man. If God wants to reach the heathen, he will do it without your help or ours." The important part was the last part, "or ours." You know, just keep us out of this. The next year, he came back with a 96-page printed book, which by a stroke of philanthropy, a man in London had given £10. Now, £10 was like about $2,000 today. And it gotten that little carefully researched statement of the case for missions printed up. That little book, called for short, An Inquiry, an inquiry. E-N, you can't find it in the catalog of a library. If you look under I, inquiry, you have to look under E-N-Q-U-I-R-Y. The slightly longer title is An Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means, Parachurch Structures, for the Conversion of the Heathens. Now, there were no parachurch structures around. I hate to use the word because I don't believe in it. I think the churches should be called paramission structures, but in any case... you have to speak the language of the native, you know. So, there were no structures around whereby anybody could be sent. And William Carey had done his homework. He'd studied the Roman Catholic tradition. He understood what the Jesuits were, how they operated. He even used illustrations of the East India Company. If we can get clear to India to ply our trade, why can't we get there to preach the gospel? Well, he soon found out that you couldn't get there. Neither the government nor the East India Company would allow any missionary or any religious person to get into their part of India. And so William Carey had to land in a Danish enclave just north of the river called Serampore. In any case, this miserable little shoestring operation, which was William Carey's, became the seedbed of many new exploits. And his book showed the way. The means he was talking about, I'm not kidding, is simply a description of how to organize a mission society. That little book has had greater impact upon the course of Protestant missions than any other book outside the Bible itself. And I wonder, you know, sometimes whether the Bible has any influence at all, seeing as how we've reasoned our way out of all the scriptures that talk about missions. But that book has had enormous impact. It's still a very readable, exciting book, but you can't buy it in any of the 5,000 Christian bookstores in this country. It isn't even in print. But it is a very amazing little book. As a result, there began to happen what I would call an era of missions, which lasted clear down to 1910. This era was characterized by four stages, not altogether different from the stages of development that we saw last night on the screen for the work of the navigators in a country. You'll be fascinated by the rough parallels. The first stage is the pioneer stage. The second is the paternal stage. The third is the partnership stage. And the fourth is the participation stage. Now, that probably never ends. These other stages end. And as you get to the end of these stages, the era itself begins to close down, because you need a different kind of missionary than you needed in the early days. And pretty soon the mission boards themselves become different in their outlook. You need schools more than church planters. You need pretty soon hospitals. Pretty soon the national church, as it grows up, needs higher education. The largest engineering school in Latin America is there because of missionaries who felt that this was the next step for the church there, and so forth. And naturally, the whole attitude and perspective changes. They begin to worry about politics and about social evils, and you begin to talk about whole different subjects from what you did in the early days. Meanwhile, though, since this, call it the first era, these missionaries didn't get beyond the coastlands. This is the coastlands era, the first era. Maybe this isn't very big. I could draw this bigger. When I do that, here, this is 1800, 1900. We'll go from 1792 to 1910 here. This is the coastlands era. And wouldn't you know it, William Carey, of course, was a young upstart, under 30. It always takes people under 30 to do the obvious. There was another young upstart who had been in IT, come back, had caused a lot of trouble, hadn't, you know, been a little bit refractory and too many new ideas, and and sort of messed the works and really wasn't a very stable person in the first place. Hudson Taylor. And he said, you know, we've got to go inland. Well, now that was the most foolish thing he could have suggested. Anybody knew you couldn't go inland into China, just perfectly suicidal. And people kept telling him, Hudson, if you want to send young people into the interior of China, the blood will be on your shoulders. And that really kind of stopped him. Until one day, finally praying through on that, it was as if the Lord told him, Hudson, you're not the one sending these people into the interior of China. I am. And that just rolled the load away. And when he went out to China that second time, under the banner of the China Inland Mission, the 25 recruits on that ship constituted 25% of all the missionaries then in China, who were all on the coastlands. And that mission eventually supervised over 7,000 missionaries, mainly in the interior of China, the largest Protestant mission in history up to that point. Well, to this day. Now, the China Inland Mission stressed the inland territories as contrast to the coastlands. Nobody really paid attention to Hudson Taylor. For many, many years, nothing happened. They just sort of, you know, shrugged him off. Another thing happened, though, in 1865. In that year, there was a country that didn't have anything but coastlands. Now, what would that be? It was a country called the Sandwich Islands. It was a separate country. Now it's a state. But the Hawaiian Islands, as they're now called, were a separate country, and they didn't have anything but coastlands. And the missionaries had done their work. And in 1865, all the missionaries were brought home with great fanfare and rejoicing that the missionary task was done. And this began to be the feeling all over the world. Bring the missionaries home. The job is done. We've turned it over to the nationals. We're in the period of partnership or maybe participation by now. And so we don't need to send missionaries anymore. Let the national do it. But Taylor said, wait a minute. What about the inland territories? Well, then Moody went to England, stirred up a lot of dust, and went to the university campuses where he never should have touched his foot because he couldn't even speak decent English. They told him, now, you know, the English are a little more proper than Americans, and you might be on a university campus in America, but certainly not in England. They didn't even want him to go to England. But he went. His chief heckler, who just made things impossible for him, was converted, became his friend. The Cambridge Seven, they yielded their lives to missions. They said, we're not going to go until we can take 100 people with us. I wish more young people today would say that. We lose a lot of momentum by young people going off to the field and not taking, sharing their vision before they go. In any case, one of those studs, C.T. Studd's brother, Richard... landed up at Cornell University, speaking to a group. There was a tall, brilliant, very, very self-confident student who was really going to be something, you could tell. And he came late. He didn't have to come on time. Just as he slipped into the back seat, Studd's brother was saying to the group, seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. It kind of shook him. And to make a long story short, he got picked up. He became the leader of the student volunteer movement. That fueled, there was a haystack meeting back here of young upstarts, and there were this student volunteer movement fueled this era and brought it into pace, and I would say it closes, say, 1980. Now, this was the second era. This was the inland era. This was a much bigger operation. thousands and thousands of people went out compared to this time. In this part of this century, people going to Africa weren't expected to live very long. 35 missionaries going under the British Methodists to Ghana over about a 30-year period. Only two of them lasted longer than 2 years. And those who went in their tracks knew perfectly well what the odds were. It reminds me of this situation in Lebanon. I'm not sure how many people would go out under those circumstances if nobody practically had lived more than 2 years. But they went. They made beachheads all around the coastlands, but in this period here, they went inland. Livingston had led the way back here, but now they actually plowed in. They went into the inland of China, inland of Africa. The older missions, of course, they didn't budge. They didn't pay any attention. A whole new bunch of missions were founded in this era here. Beginning about 1895, a suitable 20 years after Hudson Taylor had gotten started, they didn't, you know, by this time he was over 40, so they could listen to him. So 40 new mission agencies appeared. These are called today the faith missions. As usual, a bad name for them, because really they were the frontier missions. The inland missions. Listen to the names. The Sudan Interior Mission. The Africa Inland Mission. The Regions Beyond Missionary Union. The Unevangelized Fields Mission. And, of course, the China Inland Mission. And many other. The Heart of Africa Mission. All these missions stressed going where there was no work. These were indeed frontier missions. And in 1910, when this era closed, there was a major worldwide conference of delegates of mission societies who set their faces, and the older missions now turned around and faced the frontiers. And they sort of got caught up in the whoosh of the student volunteer movement. One of the students, Robert E. Speer, a very godly, determined, tremendous young leader, 24 years old, 2 years in a seminary. A man came down from New York City with a top hat and long tails and looked all around for him on the campus there in Princeton, found him out in the football field where he's lying down beside the, watching the game, tapped him on the shoulder and said, "The Board of Foreign Missions of the Presbyterian Church has invited you to be the General Secretary." He was 24 years old, never finished seminary. And for the next 40 years, he was the General Secretary of that board. And this was typical. The older boards were taken over by these younger students in a whoosh. And thousands went out across the world into the inland territories. Well, this transitional period was very confusing. These boards, up until 1910 at least, were pulling people out. The job was done. These boards were trying to send people out. In the same city, at the same time, 1865, Hudson Taylor made a deposit in a bank to start the China Inland Mission, and the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions withdrew all missionaries from Hawaii. There was a conflict of perspective. Now, that transition lasted 45 years of confusion. Today, there's another period of transition and confusion. In 1934, another young man, also under 30, who obviously didn't know what he was doing, he didn't even finish college, went off to Central America. He was part of the student volunteer movement, the very tail end of it. And he rattled around down there, was selling copies of portions of the Bible to the people of Guatemala under the Central American mission. One day he came into a village where one of the older men spoke a little Spanish and said to him, "If your God is so smart, why can't he speak our language?" And that statement was the beginning, so to speak, of the Wycliffe Bible translators. Now, the Wycliffe Bible translators are, and let's say Cameron Townsend, William Carey, Hudson Taylor, Cameron Townsend represent sort of the early prophet of the third era. which also has gotten a very slow start because of the conflict of perspective of the older era, which is now the second era. Is the first, is the second. Now, you say, well, how could Hudson Taylor be the early prophet of the third era? He was merely dealing with tribal peoples. A lot of other peoples in the world. Well, my answer to that is Hudson Taylor was only dealing with Chinese. There were a lot of other inland territories in the world, but the symbolism was there. And Cameron Townsend, in pointing to the tribal peoples, was pointing to bypassed peoples. I remember waking up with a start, so to speak, being a Southern Californian, and knowing quite a bit about Mexico, because in the California school system, they taught a lot about Mexico. They didn't say anything about the nasty things we did to the Mexicans, throwing them out of California, but they did, you know, we studied other things, at least, about Mexico. And so I was amazed when I found out that there were a lot of different languages in Mexico. I couldn't believe it when someone said there are 90 different languages in Mexico. Mexico, you know. And here, you know, they had ferreted around and found, you know, 5 or 6 million people in these smaller categories. These were bypassed peoples. The missionaries had gone inland. They were coming home. The disciples of Christ sent 90 missionaries to the heart of India. They worked there for, 150 years in all directions, reached out 50 miles in every direction, and established a church that stood on its own feet, had its own schools, its own seminary, its own ministers, everything, and then they packed up and left. We've done our job for India. Tiny little dot on that massive continent. We've covered India, you know, type of thing. But nevertheless, it symbolizes bypassed peoples. Now, one of the names applied to those peoples is the term hidden peoples. Hidden peoples, I don't know what I've talked about in the question and answer sessions and what I said this morning, but maybe I better run you by once more what a hidden people is. There is no such a thing as a hidden person. People are not hidden. They're perfectly visible. The thing that is hidden when you look at a person is the cultural tradition to which he belongs. At least that often happens. As Paul the Apostle looked at a synagogue, having grown up in a Greek town, he was sort of bicultural. He looked at those people. He could see the Jews in the front rows, never looking back. He could see the proselytes a little further back, the Gentiles who'd become Jews. And then in the back rows were the people treated with respect, except that they had to sit in the back, called the devout persons or the God-fearers. Both terms of respect. And he sensed somehow that those people weren't getting a fair shake. They were being given a hollow gospel, that if they would become proselytes, they would be acceptable to God. When clear back in Jeremiah 9:25 and 26, you can't really understand it except in the Living Bible this time. It's not the King James Version this time. But there, clear as a bell, at least in the Hebrew, if not in your English version, it makes clear that circumcision is a matter of the heart. And he knew for a fact that this is not the kind of a gospel that was being preached. And that if it were preached, it would in effect obviate the necessity of culture shift at all. And so he had his fingers on the missionary bridge out from his people into another nation. And he, in effect, went around establishing Gentile synagogues. Imagine a synagogue where the elders were Gentiles. Can you imagine anything so utterly unthinkable and outlandish as a synagogue run by Gentiles? Well, the Jews couldn't imagine this. And when that first recorded sermon of his in Antioch was over, they began to make plans, and they had a hit squad before they were through. Well, anyway, the fact is that these hidden people groups are groups of people whose peoplehood is ignored, overlooked, not understood. They're anybody, social class, business class, vocational class, linguistic class, cultural class, whatever. Doesn't matter what the reason is. If they belong to a group that really doesn't fit in any existing worshiping fellowship, where they can hear the word and bring their friends and have their friends find it easy to fit in, then we've got to start all over again. This is why a navigator approach, in its low level, almost like a house church approach, is so perfectly adapted to penetrating hidden people groups that have to have some kind of a first penetration. And how many of them are there? There are 16,750, give or take 5,000. These are just estimates. That sounds like an exact number, but you look at that table at the bottom of the poster I gave you, and all the rows, the estimates are big, round numbers. We're not trying to confuse anybody that we counted, you know, like this. These are estimates of the number of people groups within which there is no internal witness speaking their language, working within their culture. And again, this has been very, very long. This is a 46-year transition here. In 1980, the conference, the next conference since 1910 was the last time in history when a meeting was held on the world level, composed merely of delegates of mission structures. In 1980, another conference was held. There are 270 people in that conference. 57 were non-Western agencies. There was another 170 students, 440 people together, the first time a world-level conference made up of that many mission agencies, representatives, had ever been held. This was a bigger conference than the 1910 conference in terms of the number of mission agencies represented, and it was startlingly, staggeringly different in terms of the fact that there were now, for the first time, mission agencies born in Asia, born in Africa, born in Latin America. Let me give you four examples. The Indonesian Missionary Fellowship, which has a couple of hundred missionaries all over the world. The Friends Missionary Prayer Band, not a Quaker group, they just found the word in the Bible. The Friends Missionary Prayer Band, supported by about 8,000 people in South India, very, very poor people, with over 160 missionaries in North India, which is a totally foreign country to them. Worse yet, darker skin color from the south, they are very poorly treated. In fact, it's exceedingly dangerous in the north, in a rural town. They can tell you instantly where you come from. And, you know, one group of evangelists was beaten up and almost killed, and New Delhi, and the government officials ran out, and they talked to the village elders, and they said, "Why did you beat these people up? Don't you think we should have freedom of religion in this country?" And the local people said, "Well, we didn't beat them up because they were Christians. They were South Indians." Now, going into the teeth of that kind of a situation from South India is missionary work. And the Friends Missionary Prayer Band, which in its constitution refuses to accept any foreign funds, is an amazing and wonderful group of people. They have a very, you know, in this country we have pray, give, or go. And you can always just pray if you want. There, they only have two rules. Go or send. And by send, they mean give, you know, 20% or something like that. And they pray all night. They don't have to be told to pray. They are a prayer band. Or take the Evangelical Missionary Society of Nigeria, with over 200 missionaries, mainly in Nigeria, where there are 400 languages yet to be tapped, but also outside of Nigeria. Or take Oved Alvarez and his 90 university students in Peru, called AMEN, A-M-E-N, Asociación Misionera Evangélica a las Naciones. Now, they used to call it Asociación Misionera Evangélica Nacional, because surely there are lots of hidden peoples in Peru. I don't have to translate that for you, do I? Because Spanish is practically the same as English. But then, you know, their vision broadened, and fortunately they were able to reword that A-M-E-N, Curse Amin means the same in Spanish as it does in English, so they didn't want to change the name, and they changed it to Asociación Misionera Evangélica a las Naciones, to the nations. I was just down there a few days ago. They staged the first Latin American school of missiology. The word missiology is hardly even known in the United States, but it's racing all over Latin America as young people catch on to the vision not only of being churchmen, but being missionaries. It always was assumed that the only missionaries would be foreigners. And now they've got this gleam in their eye. And just this month, they're sending out 1,250 evangelists out all over Peru. And Peru is three countries, the jungle, the altiplano, and the coast. And they're in all three places. And they'll have established 100 or more churches this summer alone. Now, these young people, they're headed for Morocco. They're headed for other nations of the world. And it is up to us to help them get where they want to go. But there are 57 agencies like that showed up, all four of those, plus many other smaller agencies, many of which are stumbling in the darkness. They don't know how to organize. They need William Carey's little book. They need help. But they can do it if we'll help them. And this is a delightful, wonderful new force. Do you know what? That there are... These 57 are 57 out of 400 that we know of in the third world who send 20,000 missionaries, most of which are going cross-culturally. Now, this is very recent research. You've heard other numbers, like 200 and 3,000, 200 societies, 3,000 missionaries. Now it's 400 and 20,000. And it's not that there's that many more, but we're just discovering a few more. And that's a wonderful thing. So that today, as we look out into the third era, this era was dominated by the English. This era was dominated by the Americans. This era, I believe, will be dominated by third world initiative and Koreans and South Indians and Nigerians and Indonesians and all kinds of people going all over the world to places which, in every case, they could probably do a better job than anybody else. There are many circumstances in the world where the people next tribe over are not the best witnesses. There are thousands of years of alienation, and the best witness is a person like working with the ghetto Spanish of Los Angeles. A person from Canada would have less prejudice against him. And so it's a very important thing for us to recognize the changing of the guard. But I assure you, the confusion in this era is phenomenal, I should say, in this transition. Right now, most of the books written on missions talk about withdrawal, talk about nationalization. How many of you have heard that the job of missionaries today is to turn it over to the national? How many of you have heard that cry? Well, if you've heard that cry, you know you've heard it from a mature field. But you obviously didn't hear that from a field where there are no Christians. And so the people who are voiceless, who have no voice, who have no Christians, who have no missionaries, who have no churches, who have no people who can write urbane and witty articles in the international journals telling the missionary to go home, those people still need missionaries. And there are 16,000 places where there are missionaries of that kind that are needed. Now we can count on the help of these people. But when a country like ours, with 80% of all the trained, biblically trained people in the world, has a huge percentage of the wealth of the world, it is very unlikely that God asks us simply to pray that those people will do the job right. Well, so much for... let me just add another word here. If you look carefully at what God is doing, I've got to draw a bigger picture here now. Now I'll just draw, what's this? 2000, 1980. That'd be 70, that'd be 60. In 1966, there was the Berlin Congress on Evangelism. This is 70, 80, 90. In 1974, there was the Lausanne, the International Congress on World Evangelization, ECOWI, at Lausanne, Switzerland. 2,700 people were present. In 1976, there was a meeting of the IFMA and the EFMA, which brings together maybe 400 to 500 mission executives every year in the United States, where I was asked to give the opening address. And I talked about, in rather more vague terms than I'm talking now, about the new era and the need for a new thrust. And I outlined with a lot of graphs and statistics, you know, the task that is yet to be done. In 1978, 2 years later, I was asked to come back again just to an EFMA meeting where there were about 280 mission executives. The whole meeting for a week was given over for each executive to tabulate in terms of their contact with the world surface of humanity how many hidden people groups they felt that they would be able to contact by the year 1990. That's 1990 right there. This meeting in 1978, they tabulated all those cards, came out to 5,908 peoples. At this point, the 16,000 was already in view. And now that's quite a large number, just for that one society, since you also have the IFMA society. In 1979, of course, everybody was moving toward the events of 1980 at Pattaya in Thailand and also in Edinburgh. And 1980 was the year that was the year. I really think 1980 was the threshold year for this 20-year period during which it is possible to complete the task of penetrating, at least for the first time, these last 16,000 cultures of the world. Now, let me review one single thing. To plant 1,700 new beachheads in places where we already are is an evangelistic task of great value and purpose and urgency. To plant 1,700 new beachheads within cultures where there is no witness of any kind is not merely urgent, but is extremely strategic. Because only then, only until that first spark falls, can it grow by itself. Can we expect the people to pick up and to go for themselves at all? And so in terms of priorities, we really have to think through what we're going to do in this 20-year period. And I have high hopes that the cat is out of the bag now. People all over the world are really thinking seriously in these terms. Now, in these last few minutes, let me try to say what it is that we can do about this. I've already mentioned earlier today what I myself felt led in, to be involved in. I could just point out my own involvement in this thing here. I already mentioned I was at this meeting and so forth. In 1976, I talked to this group of mission executives. I'm not sure I persuaded them, but I think I persuaded myself that something had to be done. Here I was, safe and sound in a very strong, powerful, well-established seminary. It was an exciting thing. I had 1,000 missionaries going through my class in the previous 10 years. I was being put in touch with every square inch of the earth's surface. It was a tremendous education for me. It was not a place that you would lightly walk out of, but it seemed necessary if I was working 95% of the time with missionaries coming back from mature fields, going back to lead choirs and to all the finer points, you know, were being discussed. I just didn't feel that sufficient emphasis could be placed from that position on these untouched places. And so my wife and I, we walked out of that situation into thin air without a thread of support for the first time in our lives, because we had always been under a mission board that just paid you a salary. There was never any question about whether the money was coming through. And of course, working at a seminary was the same way. And so this was a new experience for us. But from 1976, in November to this day, we've never, you know, it was like that thing we sang tonight, I shall not want. There's not been any problem on our score. But what we have done, we have tried very honestly to size up the scope of the task. And from our point of view, it's an amazingly large, however feasible, task. It's not anywhere near too hard to complete, but it is certainly much larger than we're now faced with. We're not really confronting the task. The average church pays no attention. The average student group on campus pays no attention. The average staff worker, I don't care what organization they're working for, almost knows very little about missions. They don't know where the Christians in India are or how they got there or what is left to be done. They have no feel at all for the nature of the task. Missions is just one of those things, if you're super religious, you might be willing to consider, you know, in a weak moment, or maybe in a strong moment, maybe. And some super athletes do it and other people don't. Like some people jog 10 miles a day and others don't. And so it really is off the subject. And ignorance breeds ignorance. And young people go to their staff, they don't get any answers. They don't know where to get the answers. There are lots of books, but they don't know where the books are. And while the situation is much improved over what it was 10 years ago, we're still in a terribly serious lurch. And I don't see how there's any possibility of a major new student movement growing in this country unless there are some major radical restructurings of the student movements that are working on campuses. At the rate we're going, we will never get there. Never in the world get there. There's nothing we're doing that's leading us forward, onward, or upward. Even in 500 years, we wouldn't get there at the rate we're going. And yet the readiness, the willingness, the openness of the staff people themselves. I'm not saying there's any conspiracy to put missions out of the light. But it was last Friday that my daughter went to the weekly intervarsity meeting where they usually have 70. And this, of course, announced in advance, this was the mission meeting for the year. And instead of 70, 20 students showed up. Now, that's InterVarsity. That's UCLA. But maybe, you know, it's not quite that bad in many campuses. But to a great extent, there's not even enough knowledge to become interested. And I feel that something radically different has to be done. And I would dare say that it has to begin with the staff. We've noticed with Crusade that they're very reluctant to have the students learn more than the staff. And the staff are too busy to learn. And so there you are. Not even the Agape movement, which is the official Campus Crusade mission arm, can penetrate the campus ministry division of Crusade, which is a separate division. You've got your international division, everything, but they have divisions, functional divisions. And the campus ministry division, you know, just, you know, we've got enough work to do. Don't bother us with the Agape business, you know. Agape can't get on the campuses, even though they're part of the same organization. Now, I don't mean to say there's any bad attitudes here. It's just busyness. It's the old story of the parable of the soils. There's so many good things there growing up, you know, that the fruit really does not appear in terms of people getting overseas. Now, most of you probably have a very high respect for the accomplishment of InterVarsity in terms of Urbana. Someone was telling me at the table that, well, you know, surely InterVarsity, they you know, they really must run all over on the subject of missions. They've got a whole missions department, and they've got a lot of keen people, and they have specialized mission staff all over the country. Most of this is recent. But, you know, those thousands of students at Urbana, they never get any place. Why? They're too far away. There's no way to get there from there to here. They talk to the staff people, they talk to the pastor, they talk to the other people they know about. Nobody knows anything about the subject. And what they do know is mainly false. Either that this is the time to come home, or that the nationals don't want you, or the job is done, or that it's impossible. And some people believe all of those things. The job is too big to do, and the job is already done. They believe both. So long as the conclusion is, it doesn't need me. And so there is also a spiritual malaise that encompasses us us, I believe, as well. Now, I want to end with a story. I mentioned this Burmese development. It's not Burmese, you know, that sounds like Buddhist, but it's in Burma, of these tribal people, these Lushai people in western Burma. I told you how in 1956, not a one of them was a Christian. Now there are 23,000 Christians. In about 2 weeks, they'll have their silver jubilee. There will be maybe 50,000 people there, because the way they count Christians, you know, is a little different from the way we count Christians. There's always two or three more people that haven't quite made it into full membership of the church. So there'll be at least 50,000 people there. It'll be a tremendous testimony to the growth of a work that had absolutely nothing to do with any Western missionaries. I've mentioned this already. I mentioned that they already have a mission board. What I didn't tell you was how they support the mission board. Now, I'm not going to tell you a gimmick for fundraising. I'm going to tell you a gimmick for prayer. These people over there have a unique system. When the wife is cooking the meal, she reaches into a bag of rice, she pulls her hand out, instead of putting it into the cooking pot, she puts it over into a basket, one handful of rice, every meal. At the end of the week, the woman from the Women's Association comes around, puts that basket into a bag, and collects it up, and takes it to the market, sells it, and that is the money that supports the mission. Now, a handful of rice, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but rice swells a great deal. A handful of rice would feed a family. Feed that kind of a family. Those people don't run on a lot of food. And I suppose in our economy, that's roughly the cost of a meal for a family. But it's three times a day. That's a lot of money. And they support a number of missionaries, both what we would call home missionaries as well as cross-cultural missionaries. They reach out to the Nagas, who on the other side of the border are mainly Christians, but not in Burma. And they reach south to the Dai people, who are totally pagan peoples. And much to the consternation of these people, don't wear very many clothes and so forth. But three times a day, they're reminded in a moment of sacrifice of the purposes of God to bring a blessing to all the families of the earth. Now, what would be the U.S. equivalent of this? One of our problems in America is that we know so much, we remember nothing. We're barraged with TV and all kinds of wonderful statistics, and when it's all over this conference, you know, you may wonder, well, there is that fellow waving his hands and so forth, and that's about all you'll remember a month from now. The only way you really change the perspective permanently of a group of people is for some daily sacrificial discipline to take place. And I would think that, and at least one of our staff suggested, that the U.S. equivalent to that handful of rice method of supporting missions would be, if not three times a day, but once a day, people reached into their pockets and pulled out all the loose change they had. Now, just for fun, I want you all to stand up and reach in your pocket and pull out all the loose change, and I want to see how much money it is. I won't count it all up. I'll just get a quick average here. I don't know exactly what I myself have, but now, I'm not going to collect the money, so don't worry. You can pull it all out. Okay, how much do you have in your pocket? Here. 45. Not through yet. 67. Zero. 350 in coins? Man, he's a glutton for punishment. A dollar. $1.40. 8 cents. 72 cents. 240. Okay, now you can all sit down. I have tried this several times, and it averages to a little more than 50 cents per person. And if each day, if you get a beautiful, multicolored, pressure-sensitive label that'll go on any size of a jar with an open mouth, and put it on your dresser, and you have a prayer schedule, and every day, every evening, you pull all the loose change out of your pocket, and you put it in there, and that reminds you to pray for the frontiers of the world. I believe it will revise and reform and transform the minds and the hearts of people. Good-hearted people who now hardly ever think about the untouched frontiers. The only missionaries they ever hear about are not there. And so there's no way for them to pray much about the people that they've never heard of. And yet this way, every day of the month, they would be reminded by a conscious act of dedication, no big dedication. Now, I was working out, the Midwest staff here are in touch directly every week with about 10,000 people. There are 100 people here, each in contact roughly on the average with about 100 people. That's 10,000. If those 10,000 people, or let's just say a tenth of them, could be persuaded to enter even a 3-month or 6-month discipline to retrain themselves to think about the frontiers by this method, the amount of money you would collect would be a pretty large amount of money. You figure 50 cents a day average, that's $15 a month, times 1,000 people, that's $15,000 per month. Now, this money wouldn't necessarily come to the navigators. I think it would be reasonable to allow people to put their money in and to have the treasurer, after a period of time, send their money back to their church or to their favorite mission board or whatever. But a lot of it would come to the navigators. And I believe it would not divert huge amounts of money from anything else. And I don't think anyone would starve to death. The only thing that would happen is they would say, what am I doing this for? Every day, every day, every day. And I believe that if in Burma it works, it'll work in America. And I want to go a little further. I'm hoping this week to make contact with 5 organizations in Southern California. Campus Crusade, World Vision, Wycliffe Bible Translators, Bob Schuller, and ourselves, all 5 organizations, if we simultaneously agree to promote a loose change frontier mission fellowship across this country, which in no case will redound to money to us, but to whatever frontier cause those people individually or collectively want that money to go to, I think those 5 organizations and anybody else who wanted to help would be able to work a nationwide revolution. It would be a fad. It has to become a fad. Now, don't look down on fads. There are good ones as well as bad ones. We need missions once more to be a movement. It cannot be an intellectual or even a spiritual trip for individuals who are super athletes in the Lord. It's got to be a common, everyday, well-understood, widespread phenomenon, or we will not be able to do what God expects us to do in this hour of history. Now, if you can think of a better idea, you tell me. But at least this is one which I think is worth trying, and at least your own Midwest group or any group, part of you could try it out. You could raise $15,000 a month extra for new missionaries to go to new places with the greatest of ease by this method. More important than the money would be the retraining of the consciousness of 1,000 people every month. Now, surely there's one meeting per month where it would be appropriate for these jars to be brought and to be emptied out and for rejoicing to take place, and for maybe a videotape each month that would bring the very latest news and information of the advancing frontiers across the world. And it is perfectly possible to set up that kind of a videotape monthly system. Or if you slides or audio tape or whatever you've got, most campuses have available some kind of a videotape machine. And I would challenge you to do it. This is beyond the realm of intellectual speculation. It has to get into the grassroots. It has to be something new. It has to be something different. It has to be additional, and it has to be realistic. It has to happen every day. It can't be a once-a-year intervarsity missions emphasis Friday when 20 students come out. It can't be a once-every-two-year Urbana meeting. It can't be a once-every-whatever. It's got to be a daily new discipline which will open up our hearts to what is essentially a new challenge for most people. Only then will we draw all the appropriate conclusions, thousands of them, more than I could ever tell you or spell out for you, that will follow upon this kind of a recognition of a new challenge and of a target date for the year 2000 and for the possibility of working together with a lot of other Christian groups all across this country. I hope you'll think about this. If it sounds a little bit too realistic, well, just like, you know, this testimony tonight. If you don't have peace, just keep praying. Maybe you will have peace before you're through, and I would at least hope that that would be true. Let us just bow in a word of prayer. Our Heavenly Father, I have no right to barge into the lives of all these hard-working, high-pressured people who have many, many people to take care of and to work with and to encourage. Father, none of my words are worth anything. Let it be, Lord, your word. Let your word, whatever it is, be the word that carries through with us. And help us, Father, to do something. Not to just be blessed and leave. Not just to be challenged. Not just to be stung in our consciences and say, oh my, that was really great. But Father, help all of us to be willing to make some changes. Do whatever is necessary to engrave into the hearts, into the very personalities of all of our good people that we're dealing with, your highest priority for all of the families of the earth. And God, if we will expect great things, help us as we attempt great things. And surely if this Midwest group can be the pilot, can try things out, then other sections of the country can follow, and maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars of new money, casual, carelessly lost money, will be conserved and focused and sent, along with profound prayers and goings of many people to the hidden people groups within our own country, within every country of the world, till we can say in the year 2000 that an avowed and earnest attempt has been made to penetrate every last people group on the face of the earth. Father, burn up the trivialities that flood our lives. Allow us to escape from the secondary matters that weigh us down. Help us to distinguish between the good and the best. Help us to know that yesterday's obedience is not good enough for today. Oh God, may this conference mark new, further steps for every one of us here. We pray in Jesus' precious name. Amen.